Hello and welcome to this new edition of Viewpoints. Hope you're all doing great. On this week's show, sign of the times, some 600 Concordia University workers go on strike over hybrid work. They just don't feel that showing up at the office every day is really necessary.
The common excuse they've been giving is that they want a vibrant campus, which is a little bit strange in the sense that a lot of us are kind of locked up in our offices doing Zoom meetings with students and other employees. The right to manage is a big deal for them.
Four outstanding Nanaimo citizens received the Coronation Medal. The medal is awarded to people who have made a significant contribution to their community.
And I was totally honored and feeling totally unworthy and cried my eyes out on the phone. And everybody I told that day afterwards, I cried all over again.
And Quest Canada wants to help communities reduce their energy use and emissions. It's now recruiting municipalities who wish to join the Net Zero Communities Accelerator Program.
The main focus for us, come up with a plan for reducing energy costs and emissions across the whole community. That includes residential, commercial, transportation, water, waste, and light industrial.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
With Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Nice to have you with us, Boris Chassin with you. For the next 30 minutes or so, workers from all around the country have found a new love for remote work, but employers want them back at the office. But many of them feel times have changed and are resisting the old ways, such as the case for the 600 Concordia University workers who are on strike in Montreal. At issue, their right to work remotely as the university transitions away from hybrid work arrangements brought on during COVID-19. The strike began on September 4th, and workers have a two-week strike mandate. The QPU union represents many of the university's workers in administrative and support roles, including IT, finance, nursing, counseling, and communications. Concordia University spokesperson Vanina Mastriacci said in a statement, "They remain hopeful that there will be an arrangement that addresses the needs of both the union members and the university." Journalist Jules Bugel caught up with workers on the first day of the strike in downtown Montreal.
So my name is Michael Schmidt. I'm VP of Communications for QPU. I work at IITS. I'm one of the primary developers for the website, concordia.ca.
And my name is Jenna Rose. I work in the Sexual Assault Resource Center as a project coordinator at Concordia, and I'm a member of QPU.
So about 600 workers have walked off the job today. You guys are on strike, first day of strike. Can you tell me a little bit about what led you to take this labor action? What's sort of been going on in the labor dispute with the university?
So in a post-COVID world, obviously a lot of us were sent home to do remote work 100% of the time for over a year. We proved it could, you know, be a real solution to a lot of different issues that companies are facing in terms of their, you know, carbon footprint, basically hiring external people from all different kind of places with the right kind of expertise. When we came back to the negotiating table, we asked for a true hybrid solution that we could have as a right in our union. And the university was completely unwilling to even negotiate it, to even discuss it. So it took the threat of a strike to bring them back to the table. They did make an offer, but it was laughable. And so we're out on the picket line today to show them that we're not bluffing. We're in this to win it.
COVID has really kind of shifted the paradigm in terms of what work looks like. I mean, from your perspective, why do you feel like the university has been resistant to this demand?
Well, the common excuse they've been giving is that they want a vibrant campus, which is a little bit strange in the sense that a lot of us are kind of locked up in our offices doing Zoom meetings with students and other employees. When the pandemic hit, we all got on Teams, and they haven't asked us to get off them. Even meetings these days are all hybrid. They definitely want to remain in power, in control. The right to manage is a big deal for them. With that said, we're not asking for, you know, fully remote. We just want to have a seat at the table and to be able to decide for people in the right situations to work the way that they should be able to work.
I'm wondering as well, like, obviously we have the Quebec tuition hike coming into effect this fall. Do you feel like that has influenced the university's sort of position on how employees are treated and how much leeway you guys are getting? Because, you know, like McGill, Concordia is facing a real kind of budget crunch going into this fall. Do you think that that's changed their approach to bargaining at all?
I don't know. Maybe you'll have more to say about this, Michael, but I feel like it should have been the opposite response, because why are we getting hung up on an issue like hybrid work? Why do we have to strike for an issue like hybrid work when it could potentially actually save the university money? It doesn't make any sense to me. It's not like we're asking for, yeah, it's not a cost redistribution issue. It's not going to cost anything. So, yeah. Confusing.
Yeah, hybrid work is a non-monetary issue. We're giving the same productivity. The only real difference is that we don't have to commute for 2 hours a day. We get to a better work-life balance and so on and so forth. Having a real hybrid work solution would make it easier for them to hire people, because a lot of the time people aren't only looking for money, they're looking for that work-life balance. And so we should be able to offer this to them. The fact that the university is just completely disregarding that easy solution is beyond us.
Yeah, I mean, hybrid work is really funny because it's something that I think a lot of workers can sort of relate to. Like, yeah, why can't I work from home at least a couple days a week? On the other hand, you know, we saw at least with like the federal government, there's been a big push for hybrid work there and a big pushback and sort of the public saying, well, if you have this good job, at the end of the day, there's bigger fish to fry. What have you guys been hearing from students, from the public, from people not in the union about, you know, as you said, this being the thing that you're going on strike for, not a monetary demand or another kind of working condition, but hybrid work? Because, you know, it is kind of like new, right? It's this post-COVID world. What's the response been like?
Well, so far today, just in the, like this morning and the early afternoon of striking today, all of the students I've spoken to, or almost all of them, a huge number, I was really shocked by how many students wanted to support us. They were asking, how do we support you? What can we do? Because I think also that generation gets it, right? They don't understand why we would have to be in the office full-time either. And their university's excuse of a vibrant campus doesn't make sense to them either, because they don't care. They want Zoom meetings. They want to be able to contact us by email. And so far I've seen a lot of support from students today.
Students at CKUT talked to had a number of responses to the strike. The most common one was confusion. Most people didn't really know exactly what was at stake. When they did learn, the response was mixed.
I think having an option is always better, because I'm not necessarily always willing to come to Concordia just for a meeting, let's say, like for office hours and whatnot. So if I don't have class on that specific day, I might want to do it online, just stay home.
I personally think it's a bit silly, if I'm honest, just because there's much worse things going on right now, and striking about hybrid work versus all the other things you could be striking about related to your work, like, I don't know, higher pay, complaining about the fact that you're not able to work from home feels privileged, I guess. Also, I find just remote in general tends to encourage not doing work because you're at home, so you don't work usually.
Like most companies nowadays, not just outside of Concordia, just normal companies, office workers, they ask for that kind of days. It's three times even. Like, I'm doing an internship right now. Most people do three times a week. It's nothing out of the ordinary.
I know that opinion sometimes comes up of like, well, why are you asking for more? You already have a great job. Because we're unionized and we're protected, we should be the ones pushing for changes in the workplace. We should be the ones that are fighting these fights so that everybody else can benefit. And it would trickle down to other organizations, I think, and workplaces.
Concordia University spokesperson Vanina Mastracci declined to comment on ongoing negotiations with the union, but said in a statement that they remain hopeful that there will be an agreement that addresses the needs of both the union members and the university. The union says they're hopeful of the same as well.
So we certainly hope that we can get back to work and continue supporting the students and the faculty that we all love. You know, we love our jobs. We're passionate about education. We don't want to be on strike. We just want university to take our considerations into account when they offer us something that really should, again, be a very quick win. I personally am optimistic. The university blinked a little bit when they made an offer of some sort. I won't go into details about the contents, although it wasn't great. I do hope that now that we're actually on strike, showing them that we're serious, that we can move the needle forward and come to a compromise, a solution that works for everybody.
This has been amazing. First strike in Kupayu history. I'm Jules Bijal, reporting with the Local Journalism Initiative. Thanks for listening.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
Do you have questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
We now move out to the east end of the country, where the Quest Canada company will be helping 15 different municipalities in the Atlantic provinces to get to net zero emissions. Quest Canada has in hand a $2 million granted by the Atlantic Canada Opportunities Agency and from individual provinces. Eddie Oldfield, a senior lead of projects for Quest Canada, says they are now recruiting for their expanded net zero communities accelerator program, which was originally piloted in New Brunswick. Towns like Oromocto, St. Andrews, and Riverview have all participated. Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick.
A national organization is recruiting municipalities in Atlantic Canada to join a Net Zero Communities Accelerator program that was originally piloted in New Brunswick. With $2 million in funding from ACOA, Quest Canada will be helping 15 different municipalities in the Atlantic provinces create plans and undertake initiatives to help them get to net zero emissions. The town of Oromocto was one of the New Brunswick municipalities who participated in the pilot of the Net Zero Accelerator Fund. Here's Senior Lead of Projects for Quest Canada, Eddie Oldfield.
We'll take town of Oromocto, which is in New Brunswick. When they started with us, they did not have a plan. They had a supportive council and staff that wanted to champion the way forward. We came in and we did some exercises with them to do some creative thinking about what can be done in their community over the next 10 or 20 years. We did some in-depth action planning with them. We developed their community energy and emissions plan and followed that up with a number of other things. So that's a community that just started out, right? They don't know how to start. They don't know where to start. They don't know what the opportunities are. And we have to kind of handhold the community through a series of steps to come up with a plan. There are other communities that come to us that already have a plan, but they don't have a coordinated or structured governance around how to implement that plan. So it's literally a plan that sits on the corner of somebody's desk. What we're trying to avoid is that situation where it kind of falls off the radar and doesn't get done. We want it to be something that is embedded in all the processes of the municipal government, that there are multiple people with roles and responsibilities associated with it, that there's a clear timeline, clear deliverables, all of those sort of things. So communities that maybe halfway there still need help, and especially our communities in Atlantic Canada, many of them are small or rural, have limited resources, limited capacity, and we have to take all of that into consideration when developing a plan.
There are two ways to look at municipalities going net zero. One is in terms of the municipality itself and its own emissions from buildings and operations. The other is to look at the community as a whole, including residents and businesses. The Quest program focuses on the latter.
Our accelerator program helps the communities to develop the community side plans. Now, as part of that, they may identify corporate or municipally owned facilities like a rec center, for example, that might benefit from an energy efficiency improvement, but that's serving the wider community, right? So there is some crossover, but the main focus for us to come up with a plan for reducing energy costs and emissions across the whole community. That includes residential, commercial, transportation, water, waste, and light industrial.
Oldfield says the ultimate goal is net zero, meaning a community produces as much or more energy than it burns in fossil fuels. But communities might be at varying stages along that long-term goal.
All communities are at different stages, like I said. So some are really just starting out. Some are halfway there sort of thing. Some really need some very tailored services to help them get projects off the ground. So some of the communities we've worked with have gone through the whole program. Others are halfway, which is like Riverview, for example, was part of the pilot, but it's continuing on in order to benefit from some of the additional services that are provided in the program. St. Andrews has been through the pilot program. They're at a stage now with a plan, with an implementation strategy, where they would like to get some of the projects that were identified to fruition. So there's some services that are needed around that. For example, developing a project plan, ensuring alignment between the stakeholders and the community, identifying and applying for funding, and even help with procurement of whether it's expertise or technical services that might be needed on a particular project. So it's getting off of it, getting the project off of paper and into motion.
In order to join the pilot, the first step is political support, says Oldfield.
It does take a supportive council. In essence, you know, in order for a community to go forward, the council needs to at least signal that they have a willingness to go down this road. It doesn't mean that they right away need to adopt a net zero target, because they may not know how to get to net zero. So the first step is you have a willing council. You have a staff person that is responsible for moving things along. And as you develop a plan, these plans are typically 10-year plans. That's when it becomes clearer and clearer as to what kind of targets you can adopt. So your 10-year plan might, for example, have a 30% reduction target with a stretch target of net zero by 2050. A lot of communities would do it this way. So they have a short-term goal with clear measures, and then a long-term goal. What communities need to continue to do and understand is that these plans are living plans. Every 5 years, these plans should be revisited because new opportunities arise, new technologies, new policies, new incentive programs, and all of the rest, right? So it's a chance for a community to see how well it's doing, what progress it's making, what's working well, what's not working well, and make adjustments and add to it measures that get them closer to net zero. And I can add one more comment, and that is, I don't think any community has figured out how to get to net zero, let alone our provincial or federal governments. But it does take all of us working together to get there.
Oldfield says that one of the challenges for towns taking on the program is establishing who will take on the responsibility to help move it along. Different places have taken different approaches, he says.
One of the things we do with all the communities that join this program is a benchmark assessment. This is what we do at the beginning to identify where their strengths are and where there might be some gaps or areas of improvement. And pretty much across the board, every community we do this benchmarking assessment on identifies staff capacity and resources as lacking. And no surprise there, we're very small. A lot of our communities have very limited staff capacity. In New Brunswick, we had a municipal reform process, as you know, that led to amalgamations. Some communities have quadrupled in size, but they didn't necessarily quadruple their staff capacity. So there's some challenges there. What we do find is in the very smallest of communities, you might have three staff. You have a CAO, you might have a public works person, you know, you have counselors that volunteer their time to do things around the community. So in a very, very small community, the other thing being is because they are small, there's less, I guess, opportunities. The scale of the opportunities is smaller than you would find in, say, a bigger city, but they're easier to get at. So in the town of Perth Andover, for example, it's the CAO along with their public works and communications. You'll have what we try to avoid is a community that gets a plan that the CAO is responsible for everything because they're already doing a ton of other things. And if the plan is designed in such a way that it all falls on the CAO's shoulders, it's likely to kind of be reprioritized. So in other communities, the roles and responsibilities are shared. We'll have the CAO always have a role. Public Works always has a role. If they have planners on staff, they would have a role, but they often don't have a planner on staff and they rely on the regional service commissions for that. If they have a sustainability officer or an environmental officer, then that person would be definitely involved. But a lot of communities don't have a dedicated full-time staff on this portfolio. You would find that in the cities of Fredericton, City of Moncton, City of St. John, but a lot of smaller communities don't have the capacity for a full-time resource. What makes sense in some cases is a regional approach where there's a shared staff person working with, let's say, three or four very small communities together. That can make sense. Or you have a community that wants to hire a planner, and part of that planner's job is to oversee implementation of this plan. So they're killing two birds with one stone, essentially. There's different ways of going about it. And there's even some communities that will engage with a local not-for-profit. And that not-for-profit has the trust of the council. They have a good working relation with the municipality, and they lead the charge on implementation. There's a few examples of that right here at home in New Brunswick.
The former town of Sackville has actually partnered with a local not-for-profit in the past. For 3 years, the town hired a part-time climate change coordinator with funding through the Provincial Environmental Trust Fund. Local NGO EOS Eco Energy managed the part-time position, but the person also reported to town staff. The new municipality of Tanchamar briefly continued the arrangement. The first budget of the new municipality even included a new permanent full-time climate change coordinator, but that position was never implemented. And this year, Tanchamar dropped the funding request for a part-time climate change coordinator, instead applying to the Environmental Trust Fund to produce a wetland-themed play for youth and tour the production to local schools. Oldfield says that while the new Atlantic-wide program already has a number of towns signed up, there's still room for more.
We still have room to recruit. In fact, we don't see this as being a done deal. In other words, we are certainly hoping to continue scaling up the program, expanding to include new communities. Obviously, we can't do them all at once. But if one applies, if there's a spot, we will add them. If they apply and there's no spots left, we will certainly have them in the pipeline for next year.
That's Eddie Oldfield, senior lead with Quest Canada, working on the Net Zero Communities Accelerator program. Hi, this is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're attuned to Viewpoints.
Follow us on X at Frequency News. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
To top off this edition of Viewpoints, we conclude our journey in Nanaimo, BC, to meet up with four citizens who have just received the King Charles III Coronation Medal. This to recognize their outstanding work in the Nanaimo community. Nanaimo's Laurie Grubb, Amanda Hall, Peter Sinclair, and Constable Joshua Waldman were honored with the Coronation Medal, which commemorates those who have made a significant contribution to Canada or to a particular province, territory, region, or community in the country. They might also have made an outstanding achievement abroad that brings credit to Canada. Journalist Lauren McKenzie attended the award ceremony on September 5th and spoke with the recipients about their work and how it feels to be awarded the medal.
Laurie Grubb is the president of the Royal Canadian Legion, Mount Benson Branch 256. She shares a passion for supporting her community and veterans. She told CHOY that the award came as a surprise when she got a phone call from the MLA.
And I was totally honored and feeling totally unworthy and cried my eyes out on the phone. And everybody I told that day afterwards, I cried all over again.
She says the Legion is heavily involved with the Nanaimo community and is dedicated to supporting the veterans and their family.
We try to remember every anniversary of the different wars around town and have ceremonies. We have somebody that's in charge of that. We are all volunteers. There is no one in our branch that is paid. It's totally run. We're the biggest branch in Nanaimo, and it's totally run by volunteers.
Amanda Hall is a member of the BC People First Society, where she volunteers as a membership and self-advocate liaison. She shares her lived experiences with Williams disease, a genetic disorder that affects many parts of the body. She writes blog posts about living with the syndrome, living with diverse abilities, and teaches workshops with Community Living BC. Hall told CHOY she could not have gone as far as she did if it was not for her mom, who recently passed away.
I am a self-advocate of Nanaimo. I've been doing this for a long time, and I couldn't have done it without my mom.
One thing she wants to bring attention to is for people to treat those with diverse abilities with more respect.
Treating people with diverse abilities with more respect and everything.
Peter Sinclair is the executive director of Loaves and Fish Food Bank, which serves Nanaimo and the northern communities on Vancouver Island. Through his work, more people in those communities can access nutritious food and save food from going to the landfill. Sinclair spoke to CHOY after the award ceremony. He says this award is a huge honor.
But at the same time, I recognize that there are a lot of other people who make loaves and fishes a success, and I'm just one small part of that. And so my reluctance in accepting award is in part because it really needs to go to a whole group of people and not me. So
he says a big project they're working on is their new warehouse, which he says should receive a building permit from the City of Nanaimo any day now.
We're going to the North Island weekly. Monthly, we're out to places like Tassis, Gold River, and Zabalas. We're providing food to over 100 other nonprofits, community groups, and Indigenous communities across Vancouver Island. And that is because we see that there is an abundance of food out there. You just need the infrastructure and systems in place to actually get that food to the people in need. And that's what we're committed to doing.
He says being in his position with Loaves and Fishes means making tough decisions, but that is how a lot of work gets done.
I firmly believe that if you're just repeating the status quo over and over again, things aren't going to get better. And so you need to be bold, try new things, and you either win when you make those decisions or you learn something. And so hopefully you have a good combination of winning and learning, and you can grow from that and do even bigger things with your organization.
Constable Joshua Waltman is Nanaimo's first ever RCMP mental health liaison officer. In his position, in partnership with Island Health, he created a full-time crisis car program known as CAR 54. To better connect people in crisis to proper support, this program ensures there's a mental health nurse present on crisis-related calls. He told CHY he's incredibly humbled to be presented with the medal.
Award today, it is definitely not lost on me that it was not just me who brought this program together. There's lots of other people, including Nanaimo senior management and my supervisors who were super flexible, that allowed this full-time crisis car and partnership with Island Health to come together so quick.
He says it's gratifying to work with community members and outside agencies to see positive health outcomes.
Incredible. Our number one goal is to support people in the community, leave them in the community, in the comfort of their homes with their loved ones. And then when that fails, we work with the health authority or Island Health to come up with a plan to provide them with a little bit of support. And then more support in the hospital to stabilize and then start over again.
Another round of King Charles III coronation medals will be awarded by the Nanaimo Ladysmith Member of Parliament, Lisa Marie Barron, to 20 individuals who have made significant contributions to the community later this fall. This is Laura McKenzie.
Well, that's it for us this week. A big thank you to our journalists, Erica Butler, Jules Bugiel, and Lauren McKenzie. Our national editors were Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassin. It was a pleasure to have you with us this week, and until the next, ciao.
Or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. radio@frequencynews.ca.
Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.